From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for April 23rd, 2021. Your Milwaukee Bucks are at home Saturday with the 76ers, and your Brewers are in Chicago with the Cubs this weekend. And they're back at AmFan Field next week, though. Talk about gaming the system. A Taiwanese man got married and divorced four times in a matter of a month. In Taiwan, you get 8 days off when you get married. So he married his wife four times, divorced her three times, and got 32 days of paid vacation in a row.
Nice.
Brilliant.
Honeymoon.
Because of the Suez Canal blockage last month, now there's a shortage of garden gnomes. So where are we going to hide our extra house keys? It's the return of the Planet of the Apes. In Germany, 25 monkeys escaped from a zoo. What's disturbing about this is the zoo said, oh, we don't believe they pose a danger. We don't believe? Really? Where's Charlton Heston when you need him? And continuing with that theme, five monkeys got on the loose in Cincinnati. The cops want you to keep your distance. Really? The Cincinnati Division of Tourism has a new motto. Come to Cincinnati. We have free-range monkeys. And finally, Farmer Boys, a fast food joint in LA, is giving away free burgers for a year if you get a 2-inch tattoo of one of their logos. Of course, the idea is a publicity stunt, but I think I see a problem. They're letting the customer decide where on their body they want the tattoo. And because you have to show your tattoo for the free burger, you see the problem. On the podcast today, we have Art Rothschild, Paige Ratke, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thank you, Max. When you mentioned the monkeys in Ohio, it made me think of another story I saw this week of a woman who thought she saw a dinosaur. And as you're well aware, that woman lives in Florida. So sticking with the theme, I think. For the markets overall, it was a bit of a back and forth week. Largely treaded water, although down just slightly for the week. The NASDAQ down 0.3%, closing today at 14,017. The S&P 500 down 0.1%, closing at the bell at 4,180. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, despite adding 228 points today, closed down 0.5% for the week, finishing the week at 34,044. That's a quick look at the week for stocks. Bond market, the yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury, largely unchanged for the week, down just a fraction of a point. As we look at, you know, I think what has been a substantial set of economic data, substantial set of earnings data, just, you know, for the most part, encouraging signs that we continue to be pointed in the right direction. Joel, maybe a great place for you to jump in this week. Sometimes I like to hold you off for the finish, but I think, you know, we want to touch base on the employment data, obviously, some of the housing data, obviously, continue to see good signs there.
I'm always happy to chime in. I stick around to the end anyway. So three numbers this week, Kyle: 1982, 18 days, and 34%. So 1982, the unemployment claims keep going down. This last week, the four-week moving average, for the first time since the pandemic, got below their pre-pandemic high, which was in 1982. So for so long, unemployment claims were relatively low. We're now just below that. But a year ago, the claims were 5.3 million. This week, they were 751,000. So, or I'm sorry, 651. So you can see that's a big difference. And I'm using the 1982 number to say, you know, look, we've come down a lot, but historically, we're still relatively high. The other indicators, you know, you talk about up and down for stocks this week. It's just up for economic indicators. We didn't have a whole lot of numbers this week, but we had housing numbers. 18 days. That's the average time it took to sell a house last month. 18 days. It's a record in more than 40 years of data from the National Association of Realtors. 17.2% was the year-to-year price increase of the median house. So the prices have been going up for 109 months in a row. So the other part of that story is that the rate of sales actually went down last month for the second month in a row, but there's still high demand for houses. And the thing that's holding them back is the inventory. They don't have enough houses to sell. And that's, of course, you know, supply-demand. That's why the prices are still going up. And 34% is a number I found today. The government reported on new home sales. So we're trying to get enough new houses out there to help the inventory for the existing houses. In March, 34% of the new homes that were sold hadn't even begun construction yet. So that's relatively high. It was 28% throughout all of 2019. So that shows you the demand for houses. And the home sales, housing starts, all of that construction stuff that's feeding into the housing market, they're all back to levels that we haven't seen since 2006. So before the last recession. So housing is actually, you know, in a boom phase. One of the things that's holding it back is the inventory.
And I think as we look at housing and you look at the fact that a large portion of those homes haven't been built yet, that's a leading indicator for builders. It's a leading indicator for home goods stores. It's a leading indicator for hardware stores. As you talk about the components that go into a home and the components that go into furnishing a home once it's built, you know, those are all pretty encouraging signs for the direction we're headed. And as you look at leading indicators more broadly, encouraging signs there.
That's right. The Conference Board came out with its look. It has a monthly index of leading indicators. All 10 of the indicators that they looked at went up for the month of March. It's rare that we see that, all the components going up. And based on that, they think that the GDP, the gross domestic product for the U.S., is rising at a rate of 6% this year. 6%, that's we haven't seen that kind of if inflation adjusted GDP growth since the third quarter of 1984. Not all of us on the podcast would even remember that.
Well, a few of us do. maybe I can't include myself in that, unfortunately. You know, Paige, as we look at leading indicators, important to remember that the stock market is one of the most significant leading indicators, in that it tells us what investors expect for the months and quarters ahead. As you look at kind of the fundamental data, I think pretty encouraging signs for stocks. And then, you know, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out this week, the technical indicators for stocks, which we don't talk about often, because ultimately, you know, we really believe that long term it's fundamentals that drives the market. But the technical indicators are also setting up nicely for stocks. And yet here we are this week with good economic data, continued strong earnings reports and improving forecasts. And, you know, stocks trade a little down on the week instead of, you know, what many would expect. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, like you said, the stock market is a leading indicator. So when you're looking at stock market performance, and especially right now as we're going through earnings seasons, you have to remember that companies come out with guidance, they come out and they have their earning expectations. They try purposely to keep those expectations a little bit on the lower side so that they can surprise on the upside rather than surprising on the downside. And I know this year so far, the vast majority of companies, I think it was 77% of the companies that have reported thus far this year have reported on the upside. But again, the big thing that the investors, at least the fundamental investors, are looking at is that forward-looking guidance. And so it's not enough to say we met or beat our expectations right now. they're also looking at what do we see going forward. And so, you know, obviously inflation has been something that we've talked quite a bit about in the recent past, and corporations are talking about it too. So the highest number of corporate leaders have brought up inflation on their conference calls. And so the big thing is just looking at the expectation for growth is there. The expectation is factoring into those earnings. And then those technical indicators, like you said, we don't look at them very often, but there are quite a bit of market moves that are made just from that alone. But I think the big thing that I like to see is, you know, a big topic of conversation over the past few years have been what's driving the market. And it really has been some of those, you know, big tech names, you know, so really just a few companies driving that outperformance. But what we've seen now, which I think is an exciting thing to see, is that there's that market breadth too. So if you look at the market weighted S&P, that's up, but also the equal weighted is up. So we're not just seeing those big names outperforming, but we're also seeing that across the spectrum.
And you know what I think is so interesting is that we talk about technical indicators, we talk about fundamentals, we talk about these improving expectations. And it gets back to a point that we've made in seminars before, on the podcast before, and that is that valuations still do matter. That if we were coming into this environment the way we normally come out of a recession, where valuations are below long-term averages, where there's not an environment where stocks have run 50% year over year the way they have right now, I think as investors, you know, we throw caution to the wind at that point and say we're incredibly optimistic about the future. I think the challenge we face now is that we have priced in a lot of those expectations. And so the optimism is there, certainly, but we've got to bring that word caution back into our expectations. And Art, I know a big question that comes up in your client conversations is, you know, when's the next shoe going to drop? When's that correction going to come? I think, you know, first and foremost, from where I sit, maybe we're focusing on the wrong things, but I think there's also a misunderstanding about what corrections actually are, how frequently they occur, and what it really means for clients.
Yeah, Kyle, questions all the time. You know, things are so good, they can't stay this good forever. Something's got to happen. There's always going to be something to worry about. And our answer to that is invariably, yeah, something always is going to be out there. Something will happen. Stocks will decline. And as you've pointed out, we've talked about this, that we have what are called technical corrections frequently. You pointed out 23 out of the past 41 years, we saw a technical correction. A correction is a 10% decline. About every 4 or 5 years, we get a bear market, which is a 20% or more decline. As you're well aware, as our listeners are aware, because we've talked about it all the time, is the decline we had last year was the quickest bear market in history, both in the extent to which it declined 34-35% in a month, and the recovery was the quickest ever. So yeah, these things are going to happen, but the trick for our clients is to not focus on that. As we've said so many times, the important thing to do is to focus on your portfolio, focus on why you have what you have, and how your investments are going to meet your long-term goals and objectives, and then plan for how you're going to react for the sell-off before it happens. And what you should plan on doing, if you're concerned, is you should call us, and we're going to tell you not to do anything because you have the right things to get you through the turbulence that you should expect, because as you indicated, stocks are invariably overpriced every once in a while. That doesn't mean they can't go higher. So, you know, just be prepared. I learned that in Boy Scouts. And the old expression I learned, you know, long ago, you know, on Wall Street is a bull market climbs a wall of worry. Just expect it to happen, stay the course, and just know how you should react, how you should control your emotions and invest using your head, not your heart, so to speak.
What I appreciate about that point is that when you look at what the data shows, as you say, that a meaningful number of times, more than half the years, the market has a 10% correction. On average, the S&P loses 14.3% in any given year, but 31 of the last 41 years, the market finished positive. And so The question then becomes, are you smart enough to figure out when the bottom is so that you can get back in if you decide to get out? And the reality is that at least what we've seen recently is things move so quickly that it's almost impossible to do, even if you're really smart, even if you think you know everything that's going on in the world. And forget for a second that we've been surprised a lot along the way here. And certainly, I think it reminds investors to be humble. The one challenge in all that, I think, is that, you know, as humans, we have this desire to want to take action, right? We're risk-averse creatures. We've evolved to avoid risks. We've evolved to run from lions. We've evolved to see what we can do to protect ourselves. And so there's this response in the face of those kinds of fears that, yeah, what kind of action can we take? And I think, you know, as you've pointed out so many times on this show, the right response is to remember that you took action a long time ago, knowing that those things were possible, knowing that there was a good chance that we were going to get that 10%, 14%, 20% correction, whatever it is, but that your portfolio is positioned for it, and that given enough time, you're going to be better off having waited it out than you are trying to figure out when the right or wrong time to sell is. You know, I think in light of some of that fear of missing out conversation, another topic that comes up quite often recently, certainly not a topic that we had any conversation about 5 or 10 years ago, but that, you know, I get asked at least once or twice a week is, you know, what kind of allocations should I have to cryptocurrencies or non-fungible tokens? What kind of, you know, opportunities exist there? And Paige, I know this is something that you get asked quite a bit. Art, I'm sure you hear it as well, and feel free to weigh in, but maybe I'll start with Paige here and just, you know, Paige, can you tell me a little bit about what's going on here, a little bit about the opportunity that's there, and maybe, you know, I think most importantly, given that we're risk-averse beings, why we might want to tread cautiously.
Yeah, I think that, you know, everything that's going on with cryptocurrency right now reminds me so much of the dot-com bubble. Right. So there was a time where, you know, the internet was the new thing. Everybody wanted to get in from the ground floor. And it seemed like these little tech companies or these little internet companies were popping up everywhere. You know, nowadays we still remember Amazon. We still remember some of those other tech names that are out there. But I don't think anybody is still remembering pets.com or zoom.com. You know, there's all these different sites that just literally disappeared without anything there. And so I think that at that time, you know, the big question was, does the current price match the valuation? And as it turns out, the answer was no. And so now that we're looking at these cryptocurrencies, and it seems like a new one is popping up every single day. And like you said, there's that FOMO, that fear of missing out. And so just like people didn't want to miss out on the dot-com bubble, you now see people not wanting to miss out on these cryptocurrencies. And I think for me, the real rule of thumb is you have to ask yourself two questions. Number one, do you understand what it is and what its use is? And number two, do you know how to value it? And if the answer to either of those questions is no, then it's not something that you should be investing in. You know, that's not to say that there's no value in the concept of cryptocurrencies. We've talked quite a bit about how, you know, just like with the dot-com bubble, the interesting part was not the company, but the technology behind it, the internet and the rise of the internet. The same thing goes for these cryptocurrencies. The interesting component is not necessarily each individual currency itself, but rather the underlying technology that drives those currencies. So blockchain has been the big thing that we've been talking about. As we start to see that same technology get implemented in some of the regular financial tools that we use, you know, credit cards, banking systems, and we start to see that, you know, come into play and then take that underlying component of crypto into the real world, I think that's when we're going to start to see some of the major benefits. But right now, when it comes to Dogecoin, Ethereum, Bitcoin, whichever one is, you know, in vogue on a given day, what you're really doing is throwing a dart at a dartboard, and that's not investing, that's gambling.
If I might add, as the old guy in the team here, I think Paige is exactly correct. And the benefit of this being the place where speculation, or one of the places where speculation is being done, is it's taking the pressure off of Wall Street. So we, as sedate, disciplined investors, are buying things that are actually worth something versus, as you mentioned, that Dogecoin, whatever this, it was a joke, this Dogecoin, whatever it is. The value of that stuff that was created as a joke is worth, according to the Wall Street Journal earlier this week, over $50 billion, you know, more than Marriott and Ford. I mean, this is crazy. So, you know, I can't wait to see people getting burned by this stuff, because they'll take whatever money's left and hopefully invest reasonably and rationally in things that they can make some money over time on. I think it's an example of the greater fool's theory. People are paying something for nothing that they expect someone else to take off of their hands at a later date for more. I mean, I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Art, that is one of my favorite economic theories, right? This concept that somebody else is going to be willing to pay more for what you just bought down the road. And I think the reality is, it's how we differentiate between speculative investments or just pure gambling and actual investments, right? That you have to have an investment thesis. You have to have a reason why you think something should be worth more. Yeah, there's some theory out there about why cryptocurrencies might have a future and why they might be worth in the future more than what they're worth now. I think that's a far less compelling argument than why some of the big blue chip stocks are going to be worth more in the future, when we're buying more iPhones, when we're buying more books on Amazon, or whatever it is you buy on Amazon. It makes sense that those companies are going to be worth more. And so I think the thesis for buying stocks is much cleaner. It makes it a much easier hold long term. It also takes some of the greater fool concept out of it, right? That it isn't strictly about, is someone else going to be willing to pay more, because there's actual revenue that these companies are generating. And so I think important in everything that you put in your investment portfolio to understand why it's there, what its purpose is, why it should be worth more. Either because you bought it so cheap because people just don't understand that it should be worth more, or because it's going to grow to become something bigger than it is. I mean, those are kind of the two big ways that we can typically add value as investors, is find those things that are cheap, find those things that have high growth potential, or the best of both worlds, right? Find stuff that's cheap with high growth potential. That's the foundation for great investing. It may not be the foundation for gambling or speculating on cryptocurrencies at this point. Well, thank you for listening to the program. We enjoyed doing it for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.